Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 261, and we're going to talk about how to get rid of your van when you... Yeah, not my favorite topic, but we do need to talk about it. We're also going to talk about how to prevent your rig from shimmying and swaying when you've got too much stuff in it. A bit of pending legislation that is bad. And an interesting video that I think you should watch to see what the future of vans may be. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm entering a crazy period of my life here where I'm going to be traveling extensively over the next few weeks, so I don't know what's going to happen, but hey, you've got this episode here. We'll see what next week looks like. And yeah, I'm in a situation where my van, as I have revealed, has reached end of life. Now, that is a decision I made. The van itself could absolutely be fixed. It could be fixed. It's just a matter of money or labor or whatever. But I'm not willing to do it. I'm done. And it's possible that the fix would be so expensive that you would actually be getting near the value of the vehicle. It's always hard to value these vehicles, right? Because the blue book value of a 2011 Sprinter 2500 with the 3.0 diesel engine and several add-ons that come from the factory is one thing. But then, you know, there's all the stuff that the ambulance company put into it, such as the rear air conditioning and heat, all the lights, all the cabinetry and all that. How much is that worth? Who knows? Probably actually nothing. And then there's all the work I put in where, you know, I've got a ladder and I've got the nice max air fan and there's a bed that folds into a couch and 300 watts of solar and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, you get the point. Valuing these things is very difficult. My situation is such that I am not willing to spend any more time and money on this thing because I have spent so much money and so much time trying to get it reliable that I'm just giving up. So what do you do in that case? I mean, if you've wrecked your vehicle, like you drive it into a tree, it's pretty obvious you just scrap it. Or if the vehicle's in pretty good shape and you just want to move on to something else, then you sell it. But what if you have a vehicle that you just don't think anybody should ever drive ever again? That's where I am with this thing. And it's a little bit of an ethical quandary because what's my motivation here? Is my motivation to make as much as I can out of this? Well, yes and no, but I also feel that I have an ethical obligation not to pass this problem on to somebody else. And what I mean by that is, if I were to sell this van, even if I got it running again, I would have to sell it for pretty cheap. And the problem with that is that it's likely that the person who bought it would be somebody without a lot of money, because somebody with a lot of money is going to buy a more expensive van. And that's the trap with these old Sprinters, is that sure, you can find a Sprinter van in pretty good shape for about $10,000. Not hard to do. And you drive it, it feels great, everything is nice, it's a solid vehicle, there's 8 million tons of accessories for it. I mean, why not do that? And the answer is because it'll cost you an arm and a leg just to keep it running. Now, my van is particularly odd in that it was an ambulance, and I don't know what its history is, but it was in an accident at some point that was repaired poorly, as I learned, and there's things that are affecting it. Plus, I have the problem, and this is true for all vehicles, where in my current situation, the van needs to sit for extended periods of time, and that's bad. So when I do all this math, I'm like, I can't in good conscience pass this off to anybody unless it's somebody who's a mechanic and can fix it themselves and knows what they're getting into, and that would be a very low amount of money, or it's somebody who this is their dream vehicle somehow, and I know they have the resources to keep it running, which is exceedingly unlikely. So I have a van that has money in it. Now, if you've not heard that phrase, it's pretty common in the trades where there are things that aren't being used, but they have money in them. I heard it a lot when I was building a house in Virginia, where the workers would remove things and say, oh, there's money in that. Like, there were these weird toilets in the house that hung on the wall. They were some kind of silent toilet from the 50s. And there was money in those, to which I said, you may have it, because I am not going through the effort of trying to find somebody who wants to buy a pink wall-hung toilet. Although those people exist. They're out there. And that's true for the van, too. Sprinter parts cost a lot of money. And there are a lot of parts in that van. Many of them are new. That van has a lot of money in the parts. The tires alone have 80% wear left, and they're fancy Nokian outpost tires. I love the tires. They're on alloy rims. There's money there. All the taillights are worth something. Dash components are worth something. All the new parts under the engine are worth something. The air conditioning compressor still works. The alternator still works. It's got a fairly new radiator. It has a new turbo boost. Blah, it goes on and on and on and on. And you start adding up how much money all these individual parts are worth, and you're like, well, there's money here, you know? You should just part it out and sell it. And then I look at the fact that I don't have time for that, or do I want to do that? Parting out a vehicle is great if you are in a situation where you're home all the time and it's easy for you to just go out and take a part out and sell it to somebody on Amazon Marketplace or whatever. I am not in that situation, but I do recognize that there's value in this. So if this was a really old clunker of a vehicle that was all rotted out, like say it was like a 1988 Econoline that had the floorboards rotted out and the engine was barely hanging on, maybe it was spitting out spark plugs like some of them did, yeah, I could probably just drive that to the scrapyard and see if they'd give me $100 for it. But this isn't that. This vehicle, honestly, it kills me every time I look at it because it looks fine. I can get in the back and like everything works. I've got running water. I've got heat. I've got all the power in the world. There's a refrigerator. I mean, everything in there works, but I can't move it reliably. The easiest thing to do if you don't have the time to deal with these things and want to get something out of it is to donate it. Now, this requires that you itemize your taxes. If you don't know what I'm talking about with itemizing taxes, you're probably not in this situation. But folks who have a mortgage and have investments and things like that, or they work from home or whatever, can itemize their taxes where they can go through their list of things every year and separate what's for their business and what's for themselves and all this. And they will generally save some money on their taxes if they do this. A lot of people aren't in this situation because there's what's called a standard deduction. Obviously, I'm just talking about the U.S. here. And that standard deduction is more than you could itemize for. So if you're in that situation where itemizing is worth it for you, then you can donate your vehicle to a charity of your choice and get a tax credit for that. Basically, they take the value of the vehicle off of your gross income so that you don't pay taxes on that portion. It's not like you're going to give them a vehicle worth $10,000 and get $10,000. That's not how it works, but it does lower your tax burden, which is worth something. And it helps out a charity. And most of these charities are not actually coming to get your vehicle, you know? They don't come and take your vehicle and then sell it or anything like that. They use services, and then what happens is they take the vehicle and they triage the vehicle. They're like, scrap, 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 and they'll simply sell it for its scrap value. Used market, if it's in really good shape, they'll wholesale it and sell it on the used market. And honestly, I don't know what they will do with this van. I think it's in good enough shape where there's absolutely no rust that I think they will probably wholesale it, and then somebody will buy it sight unseen and then figure out what to do with it. That happens fairly often. All these used engines you find, that's where they come from. Vehicles come in that they buy in auction, and then they look, and then they either part out the engine or they rebuild the engine or whatever. This van is perfect for that. If somebody could take the engine out and replace the intake manifold, and then if the pulleys were put on right, I don't know, they got to figure that out. But and then put the belt back on and put the engine back, this thing would be good to go. Until something else happened. Which, you know, every single time you spend a lot of money on this, you're like, that's it. I've done it. I fixed it. Everything's great. Everything's running fine now. And then 2 weeks later, the check engine light comes on. And yeah, I am done with that experience. Now, if you decide you want to sell it yourself, you know, that's a lot of work. It takes time. And as I've mentioned before, RV Trader has been very good to me in selling the vehicles and things that I've wanted to sell that were RV related. But things are changing rapidly. Honestly, Facebook Marketplace seems to be where everything's happening. And I don't like that. But that does seem to be where most transactions are happening. So you could list your vehicle there. You can list it on eBay Motors if you want. And there are still those Auto Trader papers, although I don't know if anybody reads them. So you have that option too. But it's work. And that is the bottom line of this. If you have a vehicle you don't want anymore, how much is your time and aggravation worth versus how much is the money you could get from it worth? You have a whole bunch of options. But I'm in a situation now where I'm getting a bit older, time is starting to be precious to me, and aggravation is something I just don't have the patience for. And sure, I could probably make a few thousand dollars more if I put effort into making the van run, or marketing it in just the right way, or even taking it apart and parting it out myself. I absolutely could, but the amount of time and aggravation, it's just not worth it for me. You get to make your own decision. I can tell you, if I were 25 years old and had a place to work on the thing, I would have a completely different idea of what to do. But where I am right now, that's what's going to happen. And I'll tell you what, you know, eventually the Tiki Bago is going to go that way too. The Tiki Bago is a 73 Winnebago. Somebody saved it and fixed it all up. I mean, it had been a vehicle that was sitting around for years, and somebody fixed it all up, turned it into a tiki shack. It was glorious. And they traveled all up and down the northern coast of California and Oregon and did all kinds of wonderful things. And then it started getting too unreliable for them. So they traded it in at an RV dealer for the RV they wanted. And that's how I ended up with it. And I made that one epic journey across the country and got it to Illinois. And my intention was to keep it running. But that ended really quickly as the thing just said, no, I'm good here. This looks like a pasture. I'm staying here. And yeah, I mean, I could probably get the engine running again. But why? Why? It's not a safe vehicle. Even no matter what I did to it, I couldn't make it safe. There's no point in driving a vehicle like that around unless you're somebody who collects classic vehicles. It's now got more leaks in it and such that, yeah, eventually it's going to get hauled off to one of these charities, and they will probably scrap it just for the value of the metal in the engine and the frame. There's nothing else that's in value there. Now, all that said, when you consider all those options, if you are going to donate the vehicle, you might as well take out everything that you want. This is my thinking. I'm not donating a camper van when I finally do this, probably in the fall, because I want to take everything out of it that I can use. So I will be donating a cargo van. I don't know that I'm going to take out all the cabinets. I might. I have a garage. I could put the cabinets in the garage. That's something I could do. I will definitely be taking out the obvious components. I'll remove the solar panels because they're forever. I'll remove the solar controller. I will remove the refrigerator. The diesel heater, I will maybe remove. So why, you know, it's a perfectly good diesel heater, why not remove it? They're only $100. And the effort to remove a $100 thing, it kind of doesn't make sense. I mean, the gaskets have already been compressed, and it would only cost me $100 to get a new one. So how much effort would I be willing to put into that? You see, so you have to do the calculations there. So I don't know if I'm going to remove that. But I'm going to take out everything I can. And you know, the stereo and the dashboard, maybe. The CB, certainly. I'm taking out the CB. The dash cam, absolutely. Very easy to remove, so that'll come out. And when you start adding all that stuff up, you're like, okay, I am getting some value out of this. I mean, I'll have some stuff that I can reuse in the new truck camper or in other rigs or even just in my regular truck as well. So anyway, bunch of things to think about there as I'm thinking about them, but there are always options. You are never in a situation where you just have to live with an old vehicle that you are done with. And hey, thanks to everyone who has been so generous lately. If you'd like to support the show, go ahead and visit buymeacoffee.com/built2go, and you can give me a one-time or a recurring donation, and that keeps ads off the show. You guys have been brilliant. There will be no ads on the show for the rest of the year, at least. So thank you, everyone. Van Life News. We have exactly one news item to talk about this week, and it was brought to us by John, and it's a pretty big topic if you're in the U.S. or you like to camp in the U.S. And we're talking here about 120 million acres of land. That's a lot. That's a lot of land. And it's land that if you are a U.S. citizen, you own. You own 120 million acres of land. Did you know that? Yes, we all do. It's the Bureau of Land Management land. We actually own several different types of land in the U.S., but the what's called BLM land, Bureau of Land Management land, is typically out west in the U.S., and a lot of people camp on it. You can stay there for 2 weeks in most places with nothing. You just go out there and stay and just move after 2 weeks. Some places have some permits and special rules and stuff, but in general, on BLM land, you can just hang out, and that is wonderful. Canada has something similar called Crown Land, and it's a treasure that we have here in the United States. A lot of countries envy the land that we have in the U.S. I mean, people in England cannot fathom driving for 4 days and still being in the same country, and you can easily do that in the U.S. It's not even hard. Heck, you might still be in Texas. So this is a treasure we have, and people want to sell it. They want to sell it. The U.S. Senate has a bill that is built into this one big, beautiful budget bill where they want to sell 120 million acres of your land. And it's spearheaded by Senator Mike Lee, a gentleman who recently laughed at the assassinations in Minnesota this week. I will not say any more about Mike Lee. But, yeah, they want to sell off this land, and not only is it just going to be offered for sale, the bill requires it to be sold. And they'll come back and say, oh, well, you know, it's only a small percentage of our public land. It doesn't matter. This land is precious, and in my opinion, it should never be sold. You could say that I'm getting into politics here, but I feel like I'm really sticking in the topic of van life here, because van lifers, campers, anybody who uses this land, well, unless you're the person who happens to be able to pay for it, you're about to lose access to it if this happens. And you have to understand where this is coming from. Senator Lee and other senators like him come from states where much of the state is owned by federal land. Utah is 70% federal land. Nevada is something like, I forget the percentage, I'm not going to look it up, but you can. It's like 90% or something of that state is owned by the federal government, whereas if you go to like Massachusetts, none of it is, or, you know, very, very little amount. And some of the people who live in those states feel like, well, who's the federal government to own our land? And I think that's a lack of perspective. Their states were federalized differently than ones back east, and such things were necessary, and in my opinion, still are. So if this is something you care about, this is an issue you may wish to contact your senators about and say, hey, don't be taking my land away, yo, because that ain't cool. There's a lot of terrible things going on right now, but as far as van life goes, this is a pretty bad one. And if this passes and they sell all this land, what does it mean? Well, it just means you're going to have fewer places to go. Maybe some of the nicer places, maybe not. Again, we do have a lot of land, but this is not a good trend. And they're using this to fund this budget that they've created, which is going to create a massive deficit in the U.S. on top of the one we already have, and they're trying to find ways to fund it, and they're thinking that if we sell off some public lands, that will fund it too. Well, let me give you a cautionary tale about that kind of thinking. In Chicago, we were having a budget crunch long before I got here, and the mayor thought, well, parking is worth some money, and he sold off the parking rights for the entire city to some organization in Saudi Arabia for $1 billion. A lot of money for a city, but he sold it for the rights for 99 years. They made that $1 billion back like almost instantly. And since then, they now have control over these spaces. They've jacked up the prices and they charge the city for parking whenever the city does work on the street and blocks those parking spaces. So now Chicago got a little bit of money to get over that hump or bump. Now we have this huge burden where we have to pay Saudi Arabia for our own parking. And the stats don't show exactly how much we pay because it's not taxes paying for that. It's people. It's me, you know. There are many, many places in Chicago right now where if you park on the street, it costs $10 an hour to park or more. And the organization has been doing things like adding more and more space to their parking area that used to be free. Anyway, it's a very bad situation, and it shows that when you sell off publicly owned things, you have to be very, very careful. And I don't think they're being careful here at all. So I'm off my soapbox, but if you're a van lifer, I'll have a link in the show notes and you can take a look at this thing. But I would highly recommend you contact your senator and oppose it with loud voices. Tech Talk. Okay, Tech Talk, this is a good one. I've been wanting to talk about this for a while. I've done a bunch of research on this. So I've been talking about overloaded vehicles a lot lately because, well, I knew the situation I was going to get myself into. Side note on that. Oh, I don't know why any of you guys listen to me. No, seriously, I wish to bring my mistakes to the fore so that they may educate and inform. So you remember that I mentioned that I had looked up how much weight my truck could hold without actually looking at the placard on the side of the truck, which was much lower because my truck's weird. Yeah, I did the same thing with the camper too. My travel light camper 690W is also weird. It's like a custom one or something. I don't know. I don't have any records on it. But it has a data plate on it, and the data weight shows that it actually weighs less than the average one, thankfully. It weighs about 183 pounds less, and I think that's because it doesn't have air conditioning, which I didn't want it to have air conditioning. That's my guess. So that's good. That's 183 pounds less overloaded I will be. So yay me. But I made the same mistake twice. It just happened to work out this time. Anyway, if you have an overloaded vehicle, again, you can never change the GVWR. However, you can do things to mitigate the bad effects of it being overloaded. And I want to focus specifically on the rear of the truck or the van. This happens in vans too. In the rear of the van, you have springs and shock absorbers or some combination thereof. Most vehicles you have what are called leaf springs, that they look like leaves of metal that are interfolded and then attached, and they will keep the axles from going up in a shock absorbing way. And then you have shock absorbers that actually do the opposite. They push down on the leaf spring so that when the wheels hit a bump, they are kept in suspension between these two sets of springs, giving you the smoothest ride possible. That's basically how it works. But they also have to support all the weight. Some vehicles have coil springs, which is just what it sounds like. Instead of a leaf spring, it'll have a coil under it, and that can give a better ride if the thing's empty. My Ram truck has this. But if the thing's full, it doesn't hold the weight as well, and it tends to squat down, and I have that problem. So what do you do to fix this? Well, there are three basic things you can do, each costing different amounts of money and having better pros and cons. So first thing, and I'm going to do this, is to replace the bump stops. So somewhere on your axle back there, there is a piece of rubberized plastic or something like that that looks like a dog toy. It looks like a Kong dog toy sitting back there. And it's just attached to the axle, but it doesn't touch anything. Unless you have a lot of weight or go over a big bump. It's what prevents the two pieces of metal from hitting each other and going clang. It's just a rubber thing. It'll still make a loud noise. If you hit a big pothole and you hear bang, that's this rubber thing hitting the bottom of your vehicle. However, if you replace those with something else, it can actually help support the weight. And the two main brand names in this are Sumo Springs and Timbrons. I happen to get Timbrons. What these are Super Duty dog toys that you put in there. They're Super Duty Kongs, and they will actually hold some of the weight. So as the vehicle sags a bit as you put more weight back there, this will actually make contact with the axle and the body, or the frame, depending, and that will help support some of the weight, and it will prevent your vehicle from sagging so much. So that's a great thing. And the nice thing is that they're very inexpensive. They range anywhere from like $50 to a few $100. The cheaper ones are knockoffs, and I imagine that that material is not going to last very long. So I would recommend spending more than $100 if you do this. But the installation is very, very easy. All you have to do is literally rip out the old ones with a big pair of channel locks, or if they're bolted in, some of them are, you just unbolt them. It's pretty simple stuff. And then you put the new ones in. And you cover them with soapy water, and you snap them in place, and then you're supposed to put a 2x4 in between the new bump stop and the frame, and then let the frame down. Presumably you had jacked it up to do this, and kind of compress it into place. But that's it. It's pretty simple. I have not installed mine yet because I haven't had time, but I am definitely going to do that. That's an easy one. The next step, though, if that isn't sufficient, or that impact your ride in a way you don't like, because if you have a built-out van, you're always loaded, it could be that this is providing too harsh of a ride for you, so that might not be the best solution. The next thing is airbags. I've had vehicles with airbags. They're pretty darn cool, and I think they are superior to this bump stop thing in their performance. However, they're more expensive, they are more complicated, and they can fail. You can have an airbag pop, which is you can't really do with these other things, and then what do? You're off-road in the middle of BLM land just before somebody sells it, and then psh, now your vehicle's like lopsided because it has an airbag on one side and not on the other. On the other hand, they are adjustable, so you can adjust the ride of your vehicle for your conditions and for how much weight you have, which is what makes them really cool. Now, you don't have to install an air compressor for these. You can pump them up and let air out every time you adjust them, or you can install any manner of air compressors. Some of them are fancy, like they're automatic. You can like set a level, it'll automatically keep it there, or you can have something on the dashboard where you turn it on or whatever. That is a good way to go. There's a bunch of different ways to do that. And you're looking maybe $300 and up from there. You know, again, I wouldn't ever buy the cheapest. There are some cheaper ones, actually. If you have a coil spring truck like a Ram, there are some pretty cheap ones that actually fit inside the coils. And you literally like stuff them in the coils and then just pump them up with an air compressor. That's a really cheap way to do it. And I have that option, so I'm kind of holding that in reserve, that I can do that as well as the Timbrons, so we'll have to see how that goes. And then the last option I'll talk about here is a sway bar. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a big bar of metal that you attach from the axle to the suspension, and it prevents the vehicle from swaying side to side. And they're usually under $100, and you can install them in like 20 minutes. It's not that hard to do. If you are in a lower level vehicle, meaning if you're in a, say, a Transit 150 or a 1500 series, you know, that 1.5 half ton, the numbers and names don't make any sense, but basically if it says 1.5, it's a half ton. 2.5 is a three-quarter ton. 3.5 is a ton. So 350, 35... It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, if you're in the 1.5 range, you probably don't have a sway bar. Adding one can make a big difference. Yes, it can make the ride a bit stiffer, but it won't matter if you're in a built-out van, for example, because it's always built out, so the stiffness is something you want at that point. For somebody like me with a truck camper, where the truck will be empty sometime and have the truck camper in it sometime, I could get a stiffer ride, but I'm going to do that too, simply because it's so inexpensive, and it's a big piece of metal keeping things in place, and that will give me some confidence as I travel at near my maximum weight, shall we say. And Helwig is a big company that makes those, although I do wonder if it's not Helwig? Helwig is probably Helwig. I don't know. Anyway, those are some options you have. Now you have an overview of all the different ways that you can do this. And if it's something you want to learn more about, well, heck, just type in your specific vehicle into YouTube and then type in sway bar airbag or sumo springs or something like that, and you will see somebody installing it and telling you what to do. It is a good thing to do if you're in this situation, but remember, overloaded vehicles are inherently unsafe. Product review. This is a weird product review, like many of mine, but When I take people on these big trips, and tonight, actually, it's Tuesday as I'm recording this. Tonight, I'm flying to London to meet up with a few dozen people, and we're going to go to Scotland and Norway and Belgium. I give everybody a swag bag of sorts, you know, just kind of like a little kit. And I varied it from year to year, but it's usually just practical things. And I'm going to do that the same this time. And if you're coming on the trip, close your ears. Now, you can do whatever you want. But one of the things I'm giving the people this time is it's a magnet. Now, I almost always give folks magnets when there's a cruise ship involved because cruise ship walls are usually metal and there's often storage issues, especially if you have a roommate. And one of the things that's missing is that there are very few hooks usually on cruise ships. So I always give them a magnet or a magnetic hook. And I've done this for a while. And this year I bought a different kind of magnetic hook and I didn't think anything of it, but I just tried them out on that cruise I was on last week. And they're great. And it's not that they're great performance-wise. It's a simple design thing that makes them so great. So if you're the kind of person who has a van that still has metal walls or a metal ceiling, you want to check these out. These are swivel magnets. So imagine a flat magnet with a hook on it. You're used to those. You've seen those. These are like that, except the hook swivels. That little tiny thing makes a huge difference. It changes the leverage of the weight pulling on the magnet such that the magnet becomes much stronger. In fact, the ones that I will have linked in the show notes can hold 100 pounds, but that's 100 pounds if you hang them from the ceiling. They actually hold less weight if you put them on the wall. But again, what the swivel does is it changes the leverage such that the hook is pulling from the center of the magnet as close as possible to the wall or the ceiling. Whereas traditional magnetic hooks, you end up with the weight, but the point of leverage, or whatever it's called, the fulcrum, is further out from the magnet, giving the weight of the object you're hanging more leverage, and it will just pull the magnet off quicker. Such a little thing, but it makes a big difference. And everybody in the world is making these things. There's 100 different brands out there. The one I'm linking to is one of the better, stronger ones, in my opinion. But if you have a van that has exposed metal, even on the outside, and you occasionally want a hook but don't want to drill holes, check these out. They're about $1.33 a piece. They're not super expensive. They're the kind of thing you buy 10 of them, you just throw them on the wall and leave them there, and then suddenly, a week later, you want to buy more because you found uses for all 10. Nice, little, simple, really cool thing. Tales from the road. So, this is, what does this have to do with van life? What this has to do with van life is that if I had a van and a whole lot of time and didn't have to make any money, I could do what I just did for a very long time. What I did was I decided to come out of my bubble a little bit, and I went to a rock concert. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but it's not something I've done for a very, very long time, and I thought that I would never do it again. And then, well, you know, I'm a kid of the 80s, right? You know, the bands that you liked in high school are the bands that stick with you forever, so for some of the younger folks, these bands may sound ridiculous, and for some of the older folks, these bands might sound ridiculous, and for some of the folks my age, though, all right, they might still sound ridiculous, but it doesn't matter. This story here isn't about the band or the music. It's about the experience. But anyway, Des Plaines, Illinois is not too far from Chicago. A lot of people live there would say they're from Chicago. It's really Chicagoland. The oldest McDonald's in the country is out there and stuff. It's a cute little town. I don't mind it. And here's a weird little fact about Des Plaines. There's less gravity there. No, seriously, you weigh less in Des Plaines than you do in Chicago. You can look up why if you want to. I wrote an article about it for Atlas Obscura. I don't know if it's still there. It might be. Anyway, it's nothing to do with gravity. No, one of my favorite bands ever as a kid, and that stuck with me, and I still listen to them, is Big Country. If you're from the U.S., you probably only know Big Country from the one song they had that made it did well over here. Was called "In a Big Country." Fields of Fire also did fairly well, as did Wonderland, whatever. And so they're a one-hit wonder band in the U.S. In the U.K., they're huge. And they have never stopped selling out shows, ever. They have 7 studio albums, all of them very popular, at least most of them. And there's something about this band that is different than other bands. It's not that people just like the music. The music is kind of like a brotherhood. It's hard to explain, but if you run into another big country fan, you automatically know that you have something in common with them. It's intangible, but it's powerful. And for most of my time being a big country fan, I didn't know any other big country fans. You know, I knew like two or three, and people were like, who's that? And then they'd say, oh, they had that annoying sound, that annoying song with the guitars that sounded like bagpipes. And okay, I get all that. But for me, big country was a band that I strongly identified with, and it was, you know, it's kind of like my band. And the fact that they were coming so close meant I really had to go. And so I did. Now, they're doing one of these many one-hit wonders montage shows that are all over the country right now, where a whole bunch of bands that were never A-list bands, but had a few hits that you probably heard on the radio, would band together and hopefully get enough people that would come see the shows and make it worth it. So for this show, those bands were Bow Wow Wow, who had the big hit I Want Candy back in the 80s. Gene Loves Jezebel, who had a hit called Desire and another one called Motion of Love. Tommy Two-Tone, who did 867-5309, that phone number that everybody of my age knows and has memorized forever. And then Big Country was the headliner. Okay. Now, I didn't expect much. Everybody's old. I'm old. These guys are older. It's not like they were 14 when I was 14. They were in their 20s, so they're 10 years older than me. And when you do some research, you realize that, what is this band you're seeing, right? So Bow Wow Wow, it turns out, is touring is two different bands. There's the one that I saw that was just the bass player from the original band and had all other new personnel. And then there's the other one that has the lead singer who's most associated with the band, but she is now on her own with other people. And what's weird is now she's older, whereas her replacement in the band I saw is much closer to the age she was when they were famous. So that's an interesting dynamic. Gene Loves Jezebel was basically two brothers, and each brother has their own version of the band that's traveling. Tommy Two-Tone was actually two guys, but mostly this one guy named Tommy, and he's the only member of the original band, and that's fine. He's the singer-songwriter. I don't think anyone's going to say, you didn't really see Tommy Two-Tone. Yeah, I saw Tommy Two-Tone, who, by the way, is 78 and does an amazing job. And Big Country, only the guitar player is left from the band. Just recently, the drummer left, the bass player had left earlier, and the lead singer and major songwriter tragically killed himself in Hawaii in 2001. So that's been a long time. But it didn't matter. In fact, I had such an amazing experience that I went to the show the next night in St. Charles, Illinois. I stalked the band. I followed them because it was such a profound experience. And I don't even know if I can express this, but I learned that seeing a band is more than just seeing the band members. It's about the art form of performance and the music. And some bands can do this better than others. As it happened, all four of the acts I saw did a really, really good job. And I couldn't figure out the economics of this because these theaters I were at were small. The first one sat 800, the second one sat 1,000. There were maybe 150 people at the first show, and maybe that many at the second, maybe a little bit more. How do four bands travel with these kind of ticket sales? Now, it was a weird weekend. We had the massive protests and everything, and Rick Springfield was playing the same night that in driving distance. Okay, oh, that's fine. Well, it turns out that the way they do this is that they share band members. There was a studio bassist, a studio guitarist, and a studio drummer who were consummate musicians. I mean, these studio musicians, do not poo-poo them. They have brought you much of the music you enjoy. They are the heart of a lot of these bands. They don't write the music. They don't produce the music, but they make it happen. And these guys were pros. That drummer was up there doing Bow Wow Wow and Gene Loves Jezebel and Tommy Two Tone, three completely different sounding kinds of music. I mean, the first one is all heavy toms and timpani, and then Tommy Two Tone is just classic rocker, and Gene Loves Jezebel is kind of this punky, anyway, consummate musician. All of them were. And so that's how they can do that. They share some band members. Big Country actually has a new form up, a new lineup for their band. And they did something amazing, which is that they hired a cover band to be their band. And that sounds ridiculous, but what they did was, there was this band that was doing nothing but Big Country covers in the UK, and they hired, as far as I can tell, they hired the bass player and the lead singer of that band, and possibly the drummer. I'm not all that up on this. But they recreated the band. And the lead singer is so close to the original that I now really do believe in my heart that I have seen Big Country perform live twice. They sounded amazing. The show was amazing. At one point, they stopped the show and told everyone to come down front. Again, there's one seat filled for every 10. They had us empty the balcony. Everyone, like, kind of rushed the stage. All these geezers. I mean, everybody's there my age or older for the most part. And it was magic. It was magic. I could keep talking about this, but I'd be boring everybody. I do just want to add one last thing. My wife, who is just the best spouse anyone could ever want, came with me to the second show, and she didn't like any of these bands. You know, she didn't hate them or anything, but they weren't her music. She was just doing it because she wants to support me. And then she started liking it. Gene Loves Jezebel, not a band she was terribly familiar with. She really enjoyed that. And then Tommy Two Tone, which I had talked up because he's an amazing stage presence, in my opinion, didn't impress her much. But when Jenny came on, Jenny, who can I turn to, 867-5309, etc., then she was like, wow, this is cool. And then Big Country blew her socks off. She only knew the one song, but it was such a dynamic set that she and I were literally dancing together in the aisles at a show, which is something we have never done ever, and we've known each other 15 years. It was magic. And then the cherry on top of all this is, after the show, we went out where the merch tables are, and, you know, I spent my appropriate money, because that's where the bands make their money at these shows, certainly not from the ticket sales. And there's Tommy Two Tone sitting there with his Leonard Cohen glasses on, and he has exactly one t-shirt left. It's a women's t-shirt, will fit my wife. It says 8675309 on it. And my wife's name is Jennifer. And so Tommy Two Tone wrote on it, to Jenny from Tommy Two Tone, on the shirt that she now has, because she's Jenny. She's Jenny. Nobody calls her that, but now I know. The song is about her. She's Jenny. And her number's unlisted now, so don't bother calling. I have her number. You don't. And you're not getting it. But yeah, anytime you hear that song now, that's my wife they're singing about. And I'm actually choked up talking about this. Anyway. It was a great experience. It was a wonderful experience. And I encourage you not to overlook these shows, because at the end of the day, it's not how old they are or what anything else is. It's the music. It's the art. And if the people who made the art can still be involved with it, great. But if they can't, and somebody else has picked up the mantle to make that same art, that is wonderful. Take advantage of it. Resource recommendation. I did not expect that. Going long again, but I do want to bring up this one video here. Talked a bit about Bright Drop vans recently. These are the Chevy electric vans that were going to take over for their regular old cargo van they've had forever, but apparently now aren't. They are still making them, but they're in a weird situation where they have a lot of excess stock, and you can get them for really cheap. And the question is, can you make a camper van out of these? And a camper van builder actually went to the dealer and toured one and talked about how it drives and all the challenges and stuff, between taking this empty cargo van and then creating the electric camper van of your dreams. I won't spoil it. If you're at all interested in this, watch the video, see it for yourself. But the answer is yes, there's potential. It's absolutely there. The range is there that this would be an actually useful vehicle. But there are some weird opportunities and challenges because of the way the doors work and the seating. So these things are panel vans more than cargo vans that you're used to. They're not like an Econoline. They're like a Grumman bread truck. And that presents some interesting opportunities and stuff. So anyway, I'll have a link in the show notes to the video, but the guy's name is Ben Price with a Y, and the title of the video is Chevy BrightDrop Zevo 600 the cheapest and best electric van? The answer is yes. And I agree, the answer is yes. But if you're curious about this, check it out. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 262. I forgot the number. Music, as always, is by Simon Wegg. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And until next time, remember the words of Francis Bacon, who said, "A painting lives on through the eyes of those who look at it."